The first lesson in Zen practice is to regard it as personal and intimate, one's own. And on listening to an account of Zen, or indeed anything else of significance, it is my faith that you can trust yourself to accept that which is appropriate for you, and to pass off that which is not. Harada Roshi, the founder of our particular stream of Zen Buddhism, said that you should listen to a talk on Zen as though you were the only one listening. We tend, you know, to divide up responsibility for what is being said, possibly by the number of people that are in the audience, and maybe to listen to the speaker as though listening to someone's opinion. But truly, to learn, one must change, and one must trust oneself to change. Now, of course, there are times when you will not want to listen, not want to change. If missionary from ardent sect of Christianity, such as maybe the Jehovah's Witness, comes to your door, it may be that you will simply politely say, "No, thank you." Just as if someone comes on the radio with a very fascistic sort of line, you will switch to something else. No need to listen to such things. But if it is something that you are interested in to some degree, then please trust yourself to listen wholeheartedly. That is truly the way to change. When Dr. D.T. Suzuki gave a course in Buddhism at the University of Hawaii many, many years ago, he did not teach us in the abstract, but rather began his course by telling the story of the Buddha as the story of every person. The life of the Buddha as your life. And this is the way I think we should regard our religious practice, whatever it may be, personally. You know, the Buddha was born a prince. And it was predicted of him before he was born that he would be either a great ruler or a great Buddha, a great enlightened teacher. And his father didn't want to hear that part of the prediction relating to the possibility of his becoming a Buddha. So he trained his young son in all the manly arts of war, the manly arts of being a ruler, and exposed him to all the pleasant perquisites of his life as a prince. So he married when he was very young, some say as young as 16, fathered a child, but somehow he was dissatisfied. He was exposed, they say, to the sight of a sick person, of an old person, of a dead person, and of a monk. And in questioning his companions about these, he learned something about religion from which his father was trying to seclude him. So finally, when he was 29 years old, he left his little family in care of his father and set out in the forest to seek his spiritual fortune as a monk. You may appreciate the compassion involved in this decision, a very difficult decision. He was concerned about suffering. Why should people suffer? Why should there be illness in the world? Why should there be old age and death? He felt that he could not truly be a ruler of other people unless his own mind was at peace on this question of suffering. So he took his concerns to the leading teachers of his time. And he mastered all of the intellectual formulations which were Hindu philosophy. And you know, the Hindu mind is perhaps the most highly developed of all human minds. But he found that this was not enough. The intellectual, philosophical way was not appropriate for him. And he studied also with teachers who helped him to manipulate states of consciousness. And he mastered all of these tricks of the psyche. But still his mind was not at peace. And then he took up the practice of austerity, going without food, without clothing, without sleep, eating, it is said, only a handful of bean soup every day. And there is a Gandhara statue of the Buddha as an ascetic, seated in Zazen, a living skeleton with only his deeply sunken eyes alive. He nearly died. And he thought to himself, probably, what is the use of dying unrealized? So he accepted, they say, curds from a woman of low caste. His disciples, five disciples, which he had gathered by this time, were in despair over this action on his part of breaking the precepts, and left him. So all alone, he took up the practice of meditation, which, of course, was already well established in India at that time. And he resolved, seating himself under the Bodhi tree, that he would not give up his practice of meditation until he had resolved this problem. One early morning, he looked up and happened to see the morning star And he cried out, "Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Now I see that all beings are fully realized just as they are. Only their delusions and attachments keep them from realizing that fact." So, how is it that such an experience can release one from the life of suffering? The point is that we are always looking for something else, and we miss the thing itself. Yamada Roshi wrote on this kotsu, this ceremonial staff. The Dharma, that is the teaching, the Dharma king, king of Dharma, is just this. Just this. Actually, the Buddha said, "Now I see that all beings are the Tathagata itself, himself, herself." Tathagata. This is a word that means the one who thus comes. Sounds like a very dry expression, really. What is the meaning of thus come? The one who just comes, the one who just goes, the one who just stands up, the one who just sits down, just laughs, just weeps. Everything full and complete, with nothing missing and nothing left over, and nothing sticking to it. Only that very action itself. Yes. We are always looking beyond or behind. There is a dimension you may call vertical time, which is immediately down into the present. And even the present is a concept in such a case. Well, you know, we are all of us the Buddha. When we were young, we were the little princes and princesses. We were the center of everything. In fact, our mouths were the center of everything. Everything went in there. Yes. But as we grew older and reached puberty, we found, oh, there is somebody else out there. Yes. Some other center out there. Other centers, many other centers, many other beings, like me. And so, self-awareness grew. But most people, the love experience is still not enough. And so, we may look for help to philosophers, to intellectual formulations of the deepest truth. And for some, this is enough. For some, this is satisfactory. Or we may take up occult practices. You know, manipulations of the psyche of one form or another. There are teachers, as you know, who place great stress upon such a phenomenon as astral walking. But still, perhaps, if you take this up, you may find that it is not enough. Your mind is not yet at rest. You may take up ascetic practices, as friends of mine did on Maui 10 years or so ago, when our island was a Mecca for Aquarian people. I knew many who were going without food or living on very little food, going without clothing almost, to the distress of our local people, going without sex. I knew one young man who thought that he was being indulgent by lying down. So he rigged himself a kind of hammock, and he leaned back on this at night and dozed. This is really the path of death, and we have seen it too. People dying from fasting, dying from denying themselves, because the path of self-denial is the path of death. Perhaps you may go through such a phase as the Buddha did, and then take up Zazen. The Buddha regarded that Zazen, or meditation, as the middle way. The middle way is not halfway between extremes. But really, a creative way, a synthesis, if you like, that involves for you the best features of all possible paths. The middle way does not deny the virtue of a degree of intellectuality, of mind control, of asceticism, to some degree, and of course, of meditation. The point of Zen Buddhist practice is to realize the Tathagata, to realize things as they are, as I am, as you are, and to apply this experience in daily life. Now, the first step in Zen practice is to learn to concentrate. Concentration is not the ultimate in Zen meditation, but it is the first step. What happens when you take a test or sit for an examination in your government service? If you are fully prepared, then you simply sit and write your test. And time goes by like that. See? You don't notice that your neighbors are stirring. You don't notice that your feet are asleep. You don't notice that you are feeling thirsty or hungry. You are just writing, writing, writing. See? That is true concentration. But there is another step. See? Imagine yourself in a theater. See? You are talking with your friends before the play begins. The stage is far away. Ultimately, the lights go down, and the curtain goes up, and the play begins. And for a while, you are concentrating on the action on the stage. But very quickly, if it's a good play, it unfolds and happens in your own mind. You have forgotten yourself completely, and that play is happening right here. That is true absorption. And it is that kind of absorption that we seek in our practice. Yamada Roshi, my teacher, has said, "The practice of Zen is forgetting the self in the act of uniting with something." He is describing the fundamental way of Zazen, or Zen meditation. But we get a sense of his words in our daily life. When we are driving a car, we are just driving that car. We are not thinking, "Oh, I must shift down to second gear. Oh, I must look out for that pedestrian." See? One with the car, completely absorbed in our task, we drive from home to work or to school. But if self-consciousness arises, see, then we are separate. So concentration really is a little dualistic. You are concentrating on something. But absorption is complete unity with the task. Now, rather a long talk here, and we are behind the time, so I will skip through some of these points and summarize by stressing the importance of confidence. When I first began my practice in Japan, I noticed that Zen monks were equating confidence with realization. I couldn't understand this. Isn't confidence a kind of ego concern, I thought? Aren't they holding themselves separate and aloof in their confidence? Why can't they be more modest? Humble. I had this idea about the true religious person. But really, if you are not confident, how can you realize this very body is the Buddha, as Hakuin Zenji said? See? This is the agent of realization, right here, right there, right there. See? True for all of you, all of us. Now, confidence builds. At first, in Zen practice, you are anything but confident. But you may be confident that you will build confidence. Now, of course, there are two kinds of confidence, the pathological and the genuine. Okay? Hitler was, we may say, confident. But he needed continual shoring up, continual support. This was a brash kind of extreme egocentricity. He was continually building ego armament, we may say. This is altogether different from the true confidence of the Buddhist student, the true confidence of the Buddha himself, who knew what he was, where he came from, and what he had to do. This is the confidence we need to build in our practice. This is the confidence which builds naturally in our practice.